This podcast has been generously sponsored by Fallon Schmidt in memory of her parents, Toby Riders and Charles Schmidt, who instilled in her a love of learning, words, tradition, community and Judaism. For more information about sponsoring a podcast, email jamie@pardes.org. This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
I did Jackie just say that one of the things I do is organize the volunteering at Pardes. I'm the director of the Social Justice Track, which is the goal of the Social Justice Track is to try to use place, if that may, you know, here we are in Yerushalayim, and Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, Torah is coming out of Zion, and there's no place better than to come to Jerusalem to learn Torah, but also to feel like we couldn't do the studying that we're doing anywhere else. The Social Justice Track tries to bring people, for instance, we're studying about Jewish non-Jewish relations, and tomorrow we're going to go to the bilingual school in the neighborhood and talk about how Jews and Arabs can study together in the same place and what are the challenges of that, and we're looking at sources about that. So that's what I do with the Social Justice Track, and that's just whoever wants to take that class, but everyone at Pardes has to volunteer. We think that if you come to Israel for the year, one of the ways to make your learning sincere is to combine it with action. And one of the ways to make your relationship to the place more authentic is to create relationships here and to improve your Hebrew by creating relationships here. And so we make everyone volunteer. And there's something a little bit oxymoronish about compulsory volunteering. Thank you. So we're thinking a little.
We told them that people will learn, you will do it, and you will like.
We will. That's right. But I have to. I need like 10 more years, I think, to cultivate that you will like it. With the, let me practice it here with you guys. You will do it. And you will like it.
So that's you sound how, just like Mayer.
That's what I'm trying to say. Mayer was my Gemara teacher when I was a student here at Pardes in 1991. In 1997, I met Eliana. I was a student on a program called Nativ, which is the gap year of the conservative movement, and it was located in the building, which was then called Machon Pardes, and we spent the whole year trying to think how we could sneak into Pardes classes and be like the big kids. They're so cool. And we made a promise to each other that when we graduated college, we would come back and study at Pardes, and we did. And my roommate from Nativ was my roommate at Pardes, and she introduced me to my husband, who you met last night. So
that's beautiful.
So I highly recommend all that. Why am I telling you that? Compulsory volunteer work. Okay, compulsory volunteer work. Why do we read the book of Ruth on Shavuot? We must have talked about this by now. Speak up, Melanie. David Yartzeit. Okay, that's one good reason. Give me another reason. What? She said, because it's David HaMelech's Yartzeit, and he's born at the end of his of the Megillah.
It mentions the barley harvest.
The barley harvest, so it fits into that time of year. Okay.
Receiving the Torah for the first time.
That was the one. I'm so glad that people said multiple reasons, but that was the one I was. I don't know your name.
Sharon.
Nice to meet you, Sharon. So receiving the Torah for the first time, and Ruth has this magical moment where she says, your people are my people, your God is my God, and she accepts the Torah and becomes a Jew by choice. And there, that moment of being a Jew by choice is actually very, it has a very strong, central to the book of Ruth, and also in Megillat Esther. You probably have done this source already, but are you guys all turned to my source sheet? In section A, source number 1, on page 1 of 7. Ah, yeah, I see you've got it right there. So this one right here. Okay, the second source on your sheet, where it says Babylonian Talmud, Shabbat 88a. It said, you guys got it? Everybody got it? The first one's the hardest one. Okay. They stood, you would probably have translated it as Tachtitahar, the base of the mountain. But they translate it as under the mountain, okay? Under the mountain. That teaches that a Kadosh Baruch Hu, God's self, overturned the mountain. He put the mountain over the heads of the Jewish people. And he said, oh, would you like to accept the Torah?
It's an offering.
Well, how about some volunteer work? And that was at Har Sinai in Shmot, okay, that the Torah was hung over our head, and they said, God said, either accept the Torah or die, you pick. Okay. And
I'm dying to accept the Torah.
Exactly, die and beautiful. So he says, so Rav Acha, that's the source. This teaches the Holy One, blessed be He, overturned the mountain upon them like an inverted cask and said to them, if you want to accept the Torah, 'tis well. If not, here shall be your burial. And Rav Acha Bar Yaakov says, this furnishes a strong protest against the Torah. Who understands that sentence? Please, tell me your name.
Mark,
yes.
Well, I would interpret it as saying that it goes against the real teaching of the Torah and the real making it part of you, making it part of your life, if it's something that is forced rather than something that you come to.
Beautiful. And on a legal level, if I can just like take it to a technical legal. Okay, if I say to you, sell me your house for $3 or I'll kill you, is it a good sale?
No.
It's not a good sale. You can then go to court afterwards and say, I was under duress. It's not a good deal. So the same thing with the Torah. We say we did. Yeah, we accepted it, but we were under threat of death, so we didn't really have a choice. So that's what Rav Acha Bar Yaakov says. So therefore, it really wasn't a fair deal, and it's not fair that you're making us keep these mitzvahs. Says Rabbah, yet even so, they re-accepted it on the day of Achashverosh. For it is written, the Jews, kimu v'kiblu, okay? Kimu v'kiblu hayudim. It said that the Jews confirmed and took upon themselves what they'd already accepted long before. Okay? Kimu. I don't know how many of you have good Hebrew. Mekayim. Okay? Kiblu. Okay? We accepted. Kabbalat Torah. That's we accepted the Torah. Okay? Kimu. Now we're establishing what we accepted back then. We accepted back in Exodus, and now we're Mekayim. We're reaffirming what happened then. That's what the book of Purim, the book of Megillat Esther, is about. The entire Jewish people essentially saying what we did before because we had to, we're doing because we choose. So this idea of volunteerism is central to both the book of Ruth and the book of Esther. This idea of volunteering to be Jews by choice. There's a funny thing about volunteering, because if I asked you to tell you the word mitzvah, okay, translate the word mitzvah for me.
Literally
commandment. And some people, I don't know, when I was growing up, when they say be a mitzvah boy, or do a mitzvah, right? They meant it's a good deed. So which is it? Is a good deed, or is it a commandment? So it's a let's say it's a commandment, and to what extent is it choice? So that's a little bit what we're wrestling, what I want to wrestle with today, is what's the role of volunteer work that's done under compulsion? Okay, what's the role of volunteer work that's done under compulsion? I decided actually, because there's a lot that could be said about this in both books, but in interest of just doing one thing well, we'll do the book of Ruth, And then afterwards, if we will do the Book of Esther in like that much time. Okay, we'll just do that briefly. The opening, so the now the first source on your source sheet. Go ahead, David, you read it. Read it strong, because the people, your back is to the rest of the people. You want to read the first source at the top?
Midrash with Rabbi?
Uh-huh.
Rabbi said, this scroll, that's the scroll of Ruth, tells nothing either of purity or of pollution, neither of prohibition or permission. For what purpose then was it written? To teach how great is the reward of those who do deeds of kindness.
Okay. I don't know, I left out the word Zera somehow. It's Rabbi Zera who said this. You can see it in the Hebrew. He's asking this question, what is the Book of Ruth all about? Because we think the main reason we learn Torah is to get mitzvot, to get commandments, to get laws, and there's no laws that come out of the Book of Ruth. What's the Book of Ruth all about? It's about the reward for doing kindness. That's what Rabbi Zera says. There's something that's very ironic about this, because we actually learn tons of laws from the Book of Ruth. We learn a lot of laws about how to convert people. We learn laws, how to convert people. What other laws do we learn?
Leverage marriage.
But here, the moral of the story is all about kindness. The book is about kindness. And when we talk about kindness, we're talking about Ruth. Okay? There's a little bit of an obsession. We'll start with Ruth the Moaviah. You've probably talked, how much have you talked about Ruth as a Moaviah, as a Moabitess?
You haven't talked about
Ruth as a Moabitess yet?
Really.
Okay, well, so this is the big chance. You'll talk about it again. Okay, Ruth is a Moabitess. The word Moabite is kind of an obsession in the Book of Ruth. It appears 14 times, Moabite. The Ruth herself only appears 10 times in the book. Moabite, the word Moav, is 14 times in the book. And there's a thing about the Moabites, which is, I put it on the wrong page in your source sheet. If you turn to page 5, source number 12. Jonathan, can I ask you to read that?
Number 12,
Deuteronomy 23, 4 through 7.
No, Ammonite or Moabite shall be admitted into the congregation of the Lord. None of the descendants, even in the 10th generation, shall ever be admitted into the congregation of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on your journey after you left Egypt, and because they hired Balaam, son of Beor, from Pethor of Aram-Naharim to curse you. But the Lord your God refused to leave Balaam. Instead, the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you. For the Lord your God loved you. You should never concern yourself with their welfare or benefit as long as you live.
Okay, so we've got it out for the Moabites and the Ammonites. We're not going to be nice to the Ammonites and the Moabites, and we can't marry them. That's what it means, that they can't enter the congregation of the Jewish people for even after 10 generations. Why?
Well, they did.
They were unkind to us. Okay, they did not meet us with food and water on the journey after we left Egypt. So Ruth is a Moabitess. Okay, so we'll have to get to, eventually, we'll get to that. But you see, there's clearly something in the Torah, in the Book of Ruth, which is this anxiety about her origin in this group of, this nation of people who are known to be unkind and are therefore off limits to us. And there's something about the Jewish people that is distinguished by five characteristics. There are five things that the Jews are known for. We're known for being Rachmanim, Baishanim, Gomlei Chasidim, Shlosha Simanim. Rachmanim, that we're merciful. Baishanim, that we're modest, okay? Gomlei Chasidim, that we do Chesed. And if you don't do those three things, then you can't join the Jewish people. Okay, so we see where we're going is this sort of sense. Well, the Moabitists can't join us because they don't have this characteristic of kindness, which
where
is
are
the
those
central.
Three things from?
I said five, but there's actually three. I misspoke. There's three categories in this nation: Rachmanim, Baishanim, Vegomli Chasadim. This is a Gemara in Yevamot, 79.
You have to have all three.
You have to have. Yes. The three. What are the three characteristics? You have to be merciful, modest, and kind. And that's according to the Gemara in Yevamot 69a. So it's important to them to show us that Ruth is really a person of great chesed in order to justify her entering the Jewish people. And the word chesed actually appears three times in the book of Ruth. And two of them, she is the person who does, she's the actor, and one time God. Okay, God is full of chesedim, and one time we're full of chesed. But there's also a thing about Ruth, which is that she gets some chesed. Okay, I want to say, if we had to say it, there's another protagonist in the book, which is Boaz. Okay, and I would have thought Boaz seems to be also a bestower of kindness on Ruth, but he's not identified for that. He's identified, there's actually a literary clue that tells us why Ruth and Boaz are meant to be together. Did you learn about this already, too?
No.
Ruth, they are both called Gibor. They are called, she is called an Eshet Chayil, a woman of valor, and he is called a Gibor Chayil. And everyone knows that when you match a Gibor Chayil with an Eshet Chayil, what will you get?
Yalde
Chayil. You'll get a Ben Yishchayil, which of course is the moral of our story. But it doesn't say, actually, that Boaz is a person of chesed. But he is a person of chesed. So I want to understand, why isn't he described that way, even though he seems to be a person of chesed? So that's what I want to try to understand. I say where the... There are three basic mitzvahs, compulsory volunteer works, that frame the book of Ruth. Let's see if we can get them, okay? The three mitzvahs that move the plot along in the book of Ruth. Anybody want to guess what they are? That have to do with chesed? It starts off with the leket, okay? There's this mitzvah called leket. Which is, say what that is in one sentence.
Keeping the corners of the field for the poor.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's peah. Okay. Leket is when you, is the gleaning. Okay, so leket means it's the ability to leket. Can you translate that word? Is that fine? Collections? Gleanings. I would call it gleanings. That what it means, you'll see it. I'm about to send you to learn it in Chavruta. But that basically, when the initial harvest is made of the field, if a sheaf or two falls on the floor, the harvester is meant to leave those for the poor. Okay, the same as Rami correctly said, you also have to leave the corner of your field totally unharvested for the poor. And you also, when you make little bundles, if you forget one by accident, you can't go back for it, you have to leave it for the poor. Okay, so to basically do a little bit of a bad job of harvesting in order to leave gleanings, the ability for gleanings. And this leket, of course, moves the plot in the second chapter of the book of Ruth, is moved forward by this mitzvah of leket. Okay, there's other mitzvahs of chesed that move the plot forward. They're a little bit harder to come up with, but let's see if you guys can do them. What's another mitzvah?
Is it to do with tithing?
No, it doesn't have to do with tithing, this one.
Redeeming of the land.
Yes. Okay, you've got them both. Okay, let's start with this because I want to do it in that order. So
redeeming
yeah,
redeeming of the land.
The redeeming of the land. Go geulat ha'adama. Okay, the land is divided up into ancestral portions. Everyone, every tribe has their land, and then with each tribe, every family has their land. If you have to, you're going to see this in the Torah in a second. If you have to, someone becomes poor and has to sell their family plot, so the family should come and bail them out. Okay, that's the second mitzvah, Lulat Adama. And the third mitzvah, who said it?
Yibum.
Is Yibum. Okay, which is, go ahead, tell us what that is.
If a man dies childless, then his wife must marry his brother to perpetuate the family name.
Beautiful. Okay, so those are the three mitzvahs that really actually form the framework of the entirety of the book, and they're really mitzvahs of chesed. They're mitzvahs of tzedakah, where we're trying to help out people who are in need, to create a state of social security. It's social security that's almost at the state level. It's obligatory. Mark.
Yeah, the marriage is about the brothers of the husband. When they say that Boaz is a kinsman,
Nahum.
does that mean a brother or just a relation?
Yeah, okay. No, he's just a relation, and there it seems to be brother. So we have to account for that, but it's sitting under there, right? You'll agree with me that all of these have their own unique ways of manifesting themselves in the Book of Ruth, but these mitzvahs they're alluding to things that took place in the Torah. And we're going to have to answer Mark's question. It's like, wait a minute, it doesn't happen exactly like it says in Deuteronomy. It's supposed to happen. That's not exactly what's happening in the Book of Ruth. And we'll have to account for why that is. So that's one of the things that I want to send you to do in Chavruta now. So these are the three major mitzvahs that I would like to call them the mitzvahs of the welfare state, if you will. Right? This is the framework that the state has built, which is meant to create social security for people who become poor. And Ruth and Naomi are the receivers, the beneficiaries of this system. I'm going to send you now to Chavruta to look a little bit, to a little bit get rid of your after lunch tires. And a little bit to look at, to see how these mitzvahs manifest themselves in the Book of Ruth. So we're skipping for now the sections B and C, which are about the Book of Esther. Hopefully we'll come back to them. And we're going now to section D. Okay, section D, which is at the bottom of page 2. At the bottom of page 2, I've given you the most important things, the parts of the Book of Ruth you're supposed to read, in number 6 and number 10. Okay, do you see? It says, in source number 6, it says to read the Book of Ruth, chapter 2, basically. And in number 10, it tells you to read parts of 3 and 4 for you to understand the way these three mitzvahs, the welfare state, functions in the Book of Ruth. How well is the welfare state going in the Book of Ruth? That's your first job, is just read those passages in the Book of Ruth and to think about them specifically in terms of how they're functioning with these mitzvahs. And then afterwards you can go back, and we'll probably spend the most time on the mitzvah of Leket. But you're welcome to just do whatever you have time for on pages in section D on pages 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, I'm not expecting you to do all of that. I'm expecting you to do the verses that are mentioned in number 6 and the verses that are mentioned in 10, and then whatever time you have. It is 2:37. How long have you guys been having? You're like sort of crammed in here. Did you guys get to go up to the Beit Midrash? And that's your baby drush? Do you want to go upstairs? You're happy to be here? So why don't you go ahead next door and learn next door for, let's say, half an hour. That's enough to get into it. And I'll come around and hear how you're perceiving the functioning of these materials. How well is this welfare state working in the time of the judges? Okay, on your mark, get set, go. Let's start. I bring you back. So what do you think? When does Ruth and Naomi, when do they come back? We're going to go back to the second chapter of the book of Ruth. When do they make their way back to the Holy Land, Misdei Moab? There they were in the fields of Moab, and they decide to come home. When do they come home?
After death, when the sons die.
Yeah, but they don't come back the minute the sons die.
It's when the valley or something.
They come back at the beginning of the barley harvest. Look at that. The last verse of chapter 1. It says, Naomi and Ruth, Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, came back from the fields of Moab, and they're coming to Beit Lechem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Okay, so that's why we're reading it right now, because this is the beginning, because Shavuot is the beginning of the barley harvest, and so that what makes it the perfect book to read at this time. That's true, but why did Naomi decide to come back at this time, do you think? Food around. Okay, it could be just the weather changes. If you watch the refugee crisis, nobody wants to be a refugee in the winter. The beginning of the rainy season is a bad time to try to make your way to a foreign climate. Yes, sir. Israel.
Could it also be because after the death of everybody and her being like so far away from home, even though she might be embarrassed to come back, decision to leave when she left, but I think she would have rather been back in Beit Lechem than having stayed in Moab.
Of course, that's why she wants to come back, but I'm wondering why the timing, right? The change of weather is a good time to come back, but I'm going with Rami and Shoshana over here that maybe they have an awareness of not just of the harvest, right, that there's going to be food on the market, but also that there is this mitzvah of leket. Like, they're banking on this mitzvah, right? They are coming now because they know that food, not just people have what to eat, but they are going to have what to eat, because they know if we arrive now, we'll have something to pick until we can get ourselves settled. So they are building on this. And look what happens in the next verse. Then it says, in verse 2, and Ruth the Moabitess says to Naomi, I'm going to go now to the field, and I'm going to collect the shibulim after whoever I find favor in their eyes. And Naomi says, go ahead, my daughter. Okay, anyone want to raise some questions about this verse? What did you notice about this verse?
Well, the acceptance of her as a daughter is a perfect
relationship. Yeah, I know. They have this beautiful relationship. Isn't that nice? But about the leket, I'm with you. But I want to hear it also with the Mark.
Well, after someone whom I will please. But the leket should be, you don't have to please someone. It should just be left for you if you're there.
Yes, sir.
But here's, if I please someone, then I'll get.
Yeah, there seems to be something funny here. Why is it that she needs to please somebody? She's entitled to take this leket. It should be there for the taking, and yet she's aware that there's going to be a need for grace in order to get what she wants. Okay? There's something that's a little bit off there that's making me feel uncomfortable, because it's supposed to be tzedakah. It's a soup kitchen. You don't need favoritism at the soup kitchen to get your food, right? Even the people that are really dysfunctional and they don't know how to eat nicely, they still get food at the soup kitchen. Everyone gets. And here, she knows that she's going to need some favoritism in order to get there.
It was a rough place, a I mean, he says later, you know, I've told the boys not to molest you.
This is exactly my concern. That is my point here. Okay, if we're looking at how's the world looking, how is our soup kitchen, our welfare state functioning? So the first thing I see is she needs to find good luck. Now, what I would have thought, if you were going to the soup kitchen, okay, anybody worked in a soup kitchen, usually the whole family comes together and they get their dinner right there on the spot. Right? I mean, you wish that people wouldn't have to break, but they don't provide doggy bags. You go there, the whole family, they sit down, and everyone sits down and eats together. Why doesn't Naomi go with them?
Well, there's something about Naomi coming back to Bethlehem. It caused a stir in the entire city. She may not be especially welcome back.
Uh-huh. So one possibility, and I accept that possibility very much, is that she's afraid to show her face. Because she feels like there's a lot of hostility to her.
But there'd be hostility to Ruth, too, because she's a Moabite.
But there's for sure going to be hostility to Ruth, too, because she's a Moabite.
But it's not one soup kitchen, it's many. Uh-huh. It'll all be different, because the amount that the owners would leave for the gleaning, and the sort of people that would be around you picking, and some of them would be not so nice.
And so she needs to find a nice one.
Yeah.
Yes. And that seems to be what's going on here, but I don't know if that's how it's meant, right? That is what's happening. No question about it. I want you to see source number 3 on the source sheet, on page 3 of 7. It says, Mishnah Gittin 5:7. Ari, you want to read it for us?
We do not prevent the poor of the nations from gathering beans, forgotten cheese, and the corner of the field in the interests of peace.
Okay. One of the things that we do, mipnei darchei shalom, is that we let the non-Jews collect together with us. That seems to imply, there's a lot of things implied in that. I'm on my source sheet now. I know some of you, at the it's hard to hold both the, I recommend you have a Tanakh in front of you so that you can look at the Tanakh and also my source sheet at the same time. It's a little bit easier than trying to turn back and forth. So here in source, right
but could
here.
You still think that the fact that she's a Ruth is a Moabite? There's the nations of the world, and then there's
the Moabites. They're even worse than the nations of the world.
So even though it says they're nations of the world, they might she might think that she's not considered to be part of it.
Oh, is she? Or I mean, I'm with Rami. Do you hear what Rami's saying? Oh, yeah, look, there's a law on the book that the non-Jews are also allowed to get away with collecting from the Lekid. And Rami says, yeah, that's for the average non-Jew, but not for, that's not for, that might not apply to Ruth. That's one way of thinking of it. What's another possibility? Maybe people are not enforcing this law very well, right? We do not rebuke the non-Jews that when they want to come and collect. Okay, that seems to imply that there are some people who do want to rebuke the non. Maybe they rebuke all the non. It seems like there's a need for favoritism.
I mean, there's still the debate now over whether charity starts at home or not.
Sure. Absolutely, right. So there's a. So they. Exactly. Okay, so here's. Although the question of to what extent she's part of the home or not part of the home, but of course that is all. What's going on
right.
here? That is exactly what's going on. So you feel the power of this Mishnah, which is obviously talking about a reality where maybe there's not enough, and people would try to shoo away the foreigners. We don't want to welcome, certainly not a Moabitess, but maybe not any foreigner. And maybe people don't want to follow that law. Look at the very next one. Rami, since you're reading, why don't you? Is that it? You say it, Rami or Romy?
I'm Rami.
Rami.
So we are at
number four.
We have learned when is it permissible for any person to take of the gleanings of the field and of the forgotten sheaves and of the corners of the field after the Nemoshot have departed? Who are the Nemoshot? Rami. Said old people who walk on a star.
Uh-huh. Okay, now we know why Naomi doesn't go. Okay, what's going on here? What's go? They want to know, look, leanings belong to poor people. They're not available to everyone. They're not hefgear. Anyone who wants to take them can take them. They belong to poor people. But at some point, if a poor person doesn't come, you can claim them. Any person can claim them that's walking by. So the halakhic question that they're trying to ask there is, how do I know when this is unclaimed and I can go ahead and take it and feel like I'm not stealing from the poor? And the answer is, when the old people have come through. Right, because there's going to be a rush. Have you ever been to a kiddush? I don't know. Okay, I see. Even I know. I bet in England it works better than it does. But here you've got to be brave. You got to get in there. You got to grab your food before. And not everyone has the ability to get into the fray for the really good Yerushalmi kugel. And so. So Ruth is saying to Naomi, this is going to be a hostile environment. It's going to be like a kiddush in my shul. Okay? Why don't you stay back here, and I'll try to grab you something. Okay? So what I feel is, this was recognized, of course, old people are vulnerable. One-third of the poor people in our country, and this I think is not special to the state of Israel, actually the state of Israel is better than other countries, are poor people, are old people, because the old people are living on a fixed income, and so they need help. Okay, so it's not surprising when you can't work that, especially that old people are coming to collect the leket, and it's not surprising that they're afraid to get into the fray with the younger poor people who might be a little bit bossy, and especially if we know that people are being shooed away and there's some sort of antagonism at the space. So all of that I hear in this verse where Ruth says to Naomi, I'm going to go and collect in the Shibboleth with whoever I can find favor.
Also,
right?
It must have been heavy.
Well, it would have been good if she would have come, yeah, and then to be able to do them together.
Yeah,
but yeah,
maybe it was too difficult for her to carry all this.
So it seems. I'm with you. Yes, Daryl.
Yeah, we actually had to do that in one shul where I work. We had a wonderful kiddush lunch prepared by the temple chef with tablecloths in China, and there was a rule that I instituted that anybody over 90 or their agent got to go first.
Pre-boarding. Yafeh. Excellent. You are a good rabbi. So they didn't have Daryl. They did not. It's clear that they did not have Daryl. It makes sense, that kind of a rule, right? And that's why they thought of it. Even in LL, they have pre-boarding, right? For the people that need more help should get to go first. But it's clear that that's not what's happening here. Remember, when's this taking place? When's the Book of Ruth taking place?
In the time of the judges.
That's not good, right? The time of the judges is the time have you talked about this already? In the time of the judges, every man does as he sees fit, okay? So when every man does as he sees fit, there's no pre-boarding, okay? And that's part of the chaos here, is being created by the fact that it's a difficult society. Is even though we have this thing called leket, it's not functioning in the way that it ought to with pre-boarding and making space for the old people to come and get what they need first, and making sure that the old people are not that the foreigners are not being rebuked, and that everyone has a place to sit. That is not the what we have. And as Ima Shel Gidon said, that what's your name again?
Avis.
As Avis has pointed out, that there's even seems to be sexual harassment going on, right? That she goes on, or there's a few things. If we just keep reading a few more verses and then we'll move on from this. It so happens in verse 3, that she went and she came and she gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened by some miracle to be part of the field that belongs to Boaz, who's a kindred of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Beit Lechem, and he says to the reapers, Hashem imachem, and they answered, Yivarechecha Hashem. And just that very verse is like they walked you walked into Pardes and you and someone said, "Oh, nice to see you. Welcome to Pardes. Can I help you?" It doesn't make the news if you get greeted at Pardes. Why doesn't it make the news if you get greeted at Pardes?
It's normal,
right? So it's being said here. Why is it being said here?
Because it's not.
It's not normal. Okay, Boaz is nicer than the normal guy. Most people don't care about you. They don't care about their workers. Okay, you might as well work at Hardee's or McDonald's than when the nobody knows your name or Walmart. Here, Boaz knows the name of his workers, and he's a nice guy, and that's why this is being introduced here. And Boaz says to his servant who set over the reapers, "Whose maiden is this?" And the servant was set over the reapers answers and said, "It's the Moabite girl who came back with Naomi." And she said, "I pray you let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." So she came and has continued in the morning until now, scarcely spending any time in the hut. It's possible here, the reason that she's over there, because maybe the reapers didn't want to let her in. Maybe they thought, "Oh, you stand over there." Maybe they needed some sort of permission to join the reapers, right? And on the one hand, it belongs to all the poor people. On the other hand, hey, with all those poor people, charity starts in the home. Maybe they decided which gleaners were allowed to come in, and maybe she wasn't even allowed in. That's one possibility. I think it's definitely a serious possibility, is that she was standing on the side waiting for Boaz to come and say, "Yes, you're allowed to collect if you want to collect. You can join the other gleaners." But there's another possibility, which is this possibility of sexual harassment, which Avis already raised. Either way, what we see is you don't want to be a gleaner. Okay, it's a hard life to be a gleaner. It's a place that's not warm to foreigners. It's a place that's not warm to the vulnerable old people. It's a place that's not warm to women. And these are the people that are gleaning. Right, which means the people who need it most are having a hard time getting in there. On the one hand, we've got a system that is designed to support the poor. On the other hand, it's not serving the poor well, and the poor are feeling very, very vulnerable. That's the first thing.
Isn't that true today? That the poor don't all know their rights?
And
don't take up whatever is available.
It could be that they don't, that this is not unique to this point in history, okay? But they're calling our attention to it in this point in history. And I'm with you. That part of what makes the society, that just tells us a little bit about what we need to learn from the Book of Ruth. Right? But here we're starting off with a situation where we've got a system in place, but the system is not functioning, okay? It's not functioning very well in Yehuda at this time. And that's mitzvah number one, leket. Let's talk about mitzvah number two, geulat ha'adama. It's a funny thing because Ruth is coming in very vulnerable, right? And she knows, going to the gleaning, she's got a difficult situation. Now, when Naomi hears about who it is, about whose field she happens into, what does she say? He's one of our kinsmen. Umiko Aleinuhu. He's there. He can redeem us. He can help us out. That is an allusion to this mitzvah. I know he'll be able to redeem you. There's good news. He's going to redeem our land and take care of us, and everything's going to be fine. It's interesting because what does Boaz say when he meets Ruth in the fields at the end of chapter 2? He said, "You guys called my attention to this verse." He says, "Wait, hold on a second. Where was that exactly?"
Verses 8 and 9.
Oh, thank you. Go ahead, read them.
Oh. "And Boaz said to Ruth, 'Have you not heard, my daughter? Do not go to glean in another field. Neither shall you go away from here, and here you shall stay with my maidens. Your eyes shall be on the field that they reap, and you shall follow them. Have I not ordered the youths not to touch you?
And if you are thirsty, you may go to the vessels and drink from that which the youths draw.
And she says, Why have I found favor in your eyes? Why would you take notice of me, seeing that I'm a stranger?" And Boaz says, "It's been fully related to me all that you have done to your mother-in-law since the death of the husband, and how you have left your father and mother in the land of thy birth." You know, she's an Abraham figure, right? You've noticed this. Here she is. Okay, she's doing what Abraham did. She's left her father and her mother in the land of her birth and come to a land that she knew not. May God recompense the deed, and may a full reward be given to you by God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Under whose wings you have come to take refuge. What is there's something funny about this verse. There's something funny about the whole thing. Because Boaz is so nice to Ruth. If you think about it in chapter 2, right? She gets all these protections, all of this special treatment in the mitzvah of leket. Okay? She gets extra food, and you can even take some of the regular stuff. You don't have to just pick up the stuff that's for tzedakah. And Ruth recognizes that she's being so treated so nicely, and Boaz says to her, "Oy, because I know that you're mishpucha, and you've come to take shelter under the wings of God." What about this mitzvah?
Redeem the land.
What's he supposed to do? That's really nice if you do that for a stranger. Okay, if you adopt a family from Syria in your shul, and you get them a house, and you help them go into school, and they're strangers, and you know nothing about them, that's super nice. If they're your daughter, and you say, they're your first cousin, and you say, "Here, take first picks at the tzedakah box." Do you hear what I'm saying? You don't hear what I'm saying. I see that you don't. Boaz should be saying, "Oh my gosh, you're mishpacha. I have to do gula tada. I have to do yibum." And he doesn't jump up to do it. When does he jump up to do it? I mean, you have to like feel there's something. Okay, the pshat, look at what's happening. Look at verse 23. Okay, v'tidbach b'na roth Boaz l'leket, sorry, in English. So she came and she kept close to the maidens of Boaz to glean to the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. Okay, how long that is?
3 months.
3 months. Okay, 3 months. She's living off of tzedakah. If the first time you meet someone, you say, "Oh, you know, help yourself to as much as you want from the tzedakah pile," it's fine. But 3 months, she's been waiting for someone to step up and help her out for 3 months. And Boaz, it seems to me, Boaz is not such a great guy. Right? Meaning, I'm nicer to my relatives than that. He should have stepped up to the plate. And he did not step up to the plate. And the pshat of the mitzvah. Yes, ma'am.
I should have in somewhere hearing that he actually thought he was too old.
He thought he was right. The midrash says that. Why does the midrash say that? Because they got to explain this behavior. It doesn't make any sense. What kind of behavior is this?
He says it. He says,
you didn't go.
So you get the feeling
so
that matters
to him. Out there.
You're so nice.
You're so nice. Also, he didn't have to do Yibun. He was so nice. I thought Yibun was the brother.
Okay, good. So let's get to that. So
there was another guy that was ahead of him anyway. So yeah.
Okay, so you read.
Could you repeat that?
Okay, she's saying is he wasn't obligated to do the mitzvah of Yibum. He's not the brother. He's not obligated to that at all. He's old. Okay, get Boaz off of him because he must be a good guy. He is the hero of the story in the end. Okay, he is the hero of the story. But what I'm saying is when I'm looking at the story, I'm thinking, gosh, she might have, if you read Leviticus 25, Vayikra Kafei, Leviticus 25, it says everybody had their next of kin is going to redeem their land. And Rashi says, if your next of kin doesn't redeem your land, then what happens? Then you find yourself in greater, you find yourself in greater need. Then you sell yourself eventually. First you sell your land, then you sell your body, then you sell your body to a non-Jew. You find yourself, first you need a loan. If someone would have given you a loan, then you wouldn't have had to sell your land. If someone should redeem it. If no one redeems it, then you'll have to sell yourself to a Jew. If a Jew doesn't take care of you and you don't get redeemed from there, you'll find yourself sold to a non-Jew. This is the cycle of poverty is meant to be cut off because your relatives come and save you along the way. And Rashi says, if he doesn't have a redeemer, and Rashi says, what do you mean? Everyone's got a redeemer. Everyone's got some relative, right? Eventually you want to get to the relative. So there's something here that Boaz doesn't see himself as a relative.
Is the Rashi on the show?
No, I didn't give you this Rashi. Sorry. I gave you so many pages. I'm going to give you more. So I want you to understand, I know what I did put on the sheet, actually, is I wanted to little bit schutz on Boaz also, which is that relatives are annoying. Right? Look up at source number 8. Okay? Isaiah says, now this is the fast that I desire, to unlock fetters of wickedness, to untie the cords of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to break off every yoke. It's to share your bread with the hungry, and to take the wretched poor into your home, and when you see the naked, to clothe him, and not to ignore your own kin. Okay? We go harder and harder as things, right? Always when you've got parallel structure, we start, he's my relative, he's my redeemer. Redeemer's stronger than relative, because in biblical parallels poetry, you always want to go to the stronger word second. The thing we end here with is, umibsarcha al titzalem. Don't ignore your kin. That's because there's no one more annoying than your needy brother and your needy relative. People... Relatives are, it's hard. On the one hand, we feel a lot of debt to our family. On the other hand, it's very hard to take them in. So I wanted to, you shouldn't think that I'm not sympathetic to Boaz's plight.
The Rashi that you mentioned?
It's Leviticus 25, 26. To summarize, so where we are so far, we've got the framework of the welfare state. We've got the leket and we've got the geulata adama, but they're not working so well. Okay, Ruth and Naomi are not being rehabilitated, and their family's not there for them. Leket is tough to get at. The relatives need to be ashamed to step up and do what they need to do. This is the book of Judges. Okay, this is what it means. The book of Judges is a time where Isha Yashar Me'inav Yaseh. Everybody's doing whatever they want. The people need a king. They need somebody to redeem them. And that's where the third mitzvah comes in. Right at this moment is where the third mitzvah comes in, and that's the leverage marriage. Now, what's interesting about leverage marriage is that it's a mitzvah that cannot be forced. Okay? These are obligatory. You don't have a choice. But yibum, you've got an easy out. If you don't want to do it, then you can say no. And if you saw two things, Mark already pointed them out. Two major differences between the mitzvah as it's painted in Deuteronomy and as it's painted in the Book of Ruth. One, Mark already said, which is they're not brothers. He's a distant relative. And there's one other big difference. In the Book of Deuteronomy, what happens if the brother doesn't want to do it? Chalitza. Okay, and what does chalitza look like? You take off your shoe and...
Spit.
Okay? And we say, kacha yaseh. Okay, this is what ought to be done to the guy that doesn't have the courage to take care of his brother's family. Okay? Shame on you. And both of those two things are missing here. What's amazing is that Boaz, okay, says, is his distant relative, but there's no shaming. We take off the shoe and we don't spit. Okay, if they make it sound there like that. Now, biblical scholars, critical scholars, will tell you that, meaning the professors, that that apparently this institution was able to work with non. It wasn't just a mitzvah for brothers. It was a broader mitzvah. That's what seems to be implied in the Book of Ruth. And they'll say that, like, clearly they did things differently in those days. But I think that there's something that's really powerful going on here in terms of the way the mitzvah is being approached. When Ruth lies down at his feet, she says, ooh, what? This is the verse we were looking at together. She says to him, she says at the end in chapter 3, verse 9, Uparasta knafecha al matecha ki goel ata. Okay? You should spread your skirt over my headman over your handmaiden, for you are a near kinsman. What did she say? What did he say to her at the beginning? Bata lechasov tachat kanfei hashkina. You came to get protection under God's skirts. And she comes and she lies down at his feet and she says, you are God's skirts, my friend! Hooray! God set up a system! And you are it! Tag! That's what happens, right? Now, he waits until she comes and lies at his feet and says, right, he said, and now you understand what he said, you came to get help from God. God and not me! And Ruth says back to him, they're in dialogue directly, right? They're using the same language on purpose. Yeah, I'm taking shelter under God, and God assigned you as his shaliach. Can you do something about it? And he listens to it. What makes Boaz a hero is that he listens to it. That is the greatness, actually, of everyone in the lineage of Judah and David, is their ability not necessarily to do the right thing in the first place, but to step up after it's pointed out to them and take responsibility. Judah blows it with Tamar, and then he says, Tzadkami Mini, oh, she was right, I was wrong. David blows it with Bathsheba, but he takes responsibility. Here too, Boaz, he should have stepped up in the first place. But he does step up at the end. Once attention is called to it, he steps up and he does it, but he steps up full speed ahead. Okay, when he steps up, full speed ahead. You guys asked me, Shelley and Ari, about why 10? Why, when they go to do Yibum, he takes 10 elders of the city. 2 should have been enough. 3 should have been enough. Why 10? So the Gemara in Ketubot says on page 5 of your source sheet, source number 11, because Boaz wanted to take care of the whole problem. He wanted to say, he wanted to teach a halacha about the Moabitess. He wanted to create a public announcement that it would be okay in order to publicize the matter. He brought 10 people together because he wanted to not just take care of her, but also solve the problem as a whole of the Moabitess and solve the problem Begedol. So he brings her, he steps up and really takes care of her in a very powerful way. So Boaz learns, if you will, to do Ruth. What does Ruth bring to Boaz? I would say this about I put the next at the bottom. While we're on this page, look at source number 14. You guys asked Avis and David asked me about why did they go to stay Moab and what was going on with Elimelech in the first place. So why did he leave? Perhaps you already saw this midrash in source number 14. He was one of the notables of the place, and one of the leaders of his generation. And when the famine came, he said, "Now of Israel is going to be coming knocking at my door for help, each one with his basket." everyone's going to be snoring at my door. And therefore, he arose and fled from them. He didn't want to be forced into any tzedakah. And so he fled the country to avoid compulsory volunteer work.
But why not somewhere else?
And right, he shouldn't have got, I don't know, because that was, it's a sign of his spiritual stature was very low that he went there. But now they've come back, and what Ruth has done, really, is volunteered. The structure, you see that, look at this, the structure that HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up is really a welfare state that is very laudable. This should have taken care of everybody. We've got gleanings. We've got relatives. The relatives help you out. We've got relatives to marry you off. All of their need, had this been functioning well, everything would have been fine. But people were doing, and people were sort of doing these mitzvahs, but they were doing them with a lot of hostility and without a sense of volunteerism. And comes Ruth, and she does with love, and she shows Boaz how to act with love. And that love and volunteerism is what allows redemption to come. So I will start say two sources, and then we'll go on to Esther. Is that source number 16? Whenever a person gives charity to a poor person with an unpleasant countenance, with his face buried in the earth, he loses and destroys his merit even if he gives him 1,000 gold pieces. Instead, you should give him with a pleasant countenance and with happiness, commiserating with him about his troubles. As Job states, did I not weep for those who face difficult times? Did not my soul feel sorrow for the destitute? And he should speak to him with words of sympathy and comfort, which states, I would bring joy to a widow's heart. What was going wrong? They were doing a little bit of leket, but they were doing it with their face in the ground and with a lot of bitterness. And steps and root first mirrors it to Nomi. Let me take care of you. Let me be the pre-boarding on your behalf, right? She goes to the field. They don't have a pre-boarding at the Leket field, but she takes care of her Nimusha, her little old lady, and makes sure that she's taken care of, and does it with love and with care. And she's graceful to Boaz. She gives him a chance to come to it on his own, and he does. He's able to hear that invitation, and that invitation is what's able to bring redemption. And you see in source 15, let's just we'll end this little section with source 15, Lini Halayla, that's what Boaz says to her. Okay, sleep here tonight, he says to her while she's at her feet. You're presently in exile, this is God. You are presently in exile and occupied informing your sons there of Torah and good deeds. God says to the children of Israel, I stay there in exile for tonight, for now, for the moment. You're busy and you're doing Torah and good deeds. And if your good deeds shall testify in favor to deliver you, right, then you shall be delivered. And if not, I shall redeem you myself, swears God. Lie until the morning, okay? So so what God is saying is, hey, if you do things right, you can be the knafayim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You can provide the protection. And if not, God will come and take care of it. And what Ruth does is empowers Boaz to actually cause the Jewish people to be redeemed, have their good deeds testified in favor of them, and that they actually become delivered themselves. That they are able to pull themselves out without any help necessarily. God sets up the system, and they come with love and volunteer work, and then redemption comes, which is the redemption of the birth of the Mashiach, leadership, which really teaches everybody the direction they need to go and teaches people how to take responsibility, because that's what a leader does, really. A leader takes responsibility not because he's compelled, because he's forced to do it, not because you will like it, but because he really likes it. That's the book of Ruth. I think it's just, to me, it's beautiful the way God set up these mitzvahs, and these mitzvahs move, they really push through the whole plot, but they're not working until someone comes with love, with chesed, and the love and the chesed allows the redemption to come in a totally different way. And that is what the Moabitess, right? She turns out that the Moabitess, Dafka, is the person who can show us that, because she's not a Moabitess at all. She's a person of deep chesed, and Moabitess is a characteristic, not a genealogy. Okay, we got 10 minutes. Let's look at the book of it. Comments on this up till now? We could stop here. Yes, Daryl.
Parallels between Ruth and Tamar.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're both going beyond the general norms of society.
Mm-hmm.
With Lot's daughters and Tamar go beyond the sexual norms of society, and Ruth and Tamar are also going beyond the norms of society. What's the nimshal that's being conveyed?
I have a class on that.
Mishnah's on Wednesday.
You're going to have a class
Wednesday.
On Wednesday. You'll have that class.
Oh.
There's no question that there's a very deliberate parallel,
yeah.
Right? The Moav comes from Benot Lot,
yeah.
So that's very clear. Okay, so I leave that to the next person. Yes.
What were the two? I may have missed it, but the two definitions of Eshet Chayil and Gibor Chayil.
Eshet Chayil, woman of valor. Gibor
yeah.
Chayil, man of valor. Hero of valor.
But what in context was that?
That was the way that the Torah describes Ruth and Boaz, and that seems to like destine them to be a match with one another because of this characteristic. But there's this other piece, right, which the piece that Boaz needs to, this they have naturally. Boaz is this by himself. But Ruth teaches him not just to be a person of chayil, but also to be a person of chesed.
Chayil means responsibility or competence.
Ooh,
or
good question.
Okay.
Chayil is a person of strength, valor, bravery, good virtue as well. I think here it's all about virtue. The fact that she's a, right, we can read on Friday nights about the things that she does. She's a real busy, she does a lot of laundry, it seems like. But she is. Cooks and supervises and does everything so very, very well. Okay, let's see if we have just a couple minutes. We'll see if we can look at how this similar motif plays out. Let's go backwards to page one in our source sheet. Let's just see if we can fill in this chart. Let's fill it in together. The development of Purim is a holiday. The thing about Megillat Ruth, Megillat Esther, is it doesn't end when it's over. Have you ever noticed this? It's like the story ends, and then it goes on forever. And one can really wonder, like, why is that it has to keep going? And you guys, when you do this outside of Yerushalayim, most people are fasting and they're hungry, and the Megillah is draying on, excuse me. I start to lose patience with it myself. But it's the longest chapter by far. And the rabbis understand this ninth chapter as a chapter of a sort of going back and forth negotiations between the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael and Mordechai and Esther, where the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael, I think we heard a little bit of this last night from Mike Eisenberg about the ambivalence of having an exilic holiday. What does it mean to have an exilic holiday? And the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael are like, we don't want to make a holiday about something that happened in the world of exile. And Mordechai and Esther are insisting on it in this negotiations. That's how the rabbis of the Talmud read it. But I think that you can actually see that there's something going on in the book of a moving back and forth. That Mordechai is even negotiating in those negotiations, the stages of the negotiations, that the holiday is changing slightly in its way. So let's see if you can just Wait a minute. Both of us are sorry. Here it is. Okay. Chapter 9. If you can keep your... So it starts off with the spontaneous holiday. When they first win in chapter 9, 17 and 18. Simone, you want to read that? Do you have? Oh, it's hard to hold this. Yeah, open your Bible in front of you if you can. It's easier to do both at the same time. Pass it on to someone else. Thanks.
On the 13th of the month of Adar, and they rested on the 14th of thereof, and made it a day of feasting and joy. And the Jews who were in Shushan assembled on the 13th thereof, and on the 14th thereof, and rested on the 15th thereof, and made it a day of feasting and joy.
Okay, so let's talk about what the natural... This is what the Persian Jews do on their natural spontaneous holiday at the moment. What can we notice? How do they observe? Feasting and joy. Okay, where did they get this idea? Did you have Michael Hatton yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you already know. Why did they think of this? Because they're Persians.
Right.
You know, it's like, they're Persians. Persian people drink a lot of alcohol. And they're assimilated. Their natural inclination is to have a beer. And the other thing they do is they celebrate on separate days. Every man... Every person celebrates when she is redeemed. Some people are redeemed on the 13th, on the 14th, and some people are redeemed. Some people are redeemed on the 13th and celebrate on the 14th. Some people are redeemed on the 14th and celebrate on the 15th. Everyone can celebrate whenever is convenient for them. Okay? That's in the first stage of the holiday. In the next stage, verse 19, go ahead, keep reading. I'm on in chapter 9, verse 19.
Therefore, the Jewish villagers who live in open towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of joy and feasting and a festive day and sending portions to one another.
I'm just going to say what I'm doing. What I'm doing is I'm looking at the ninth chapter of Megillah, and I'm filling in the chart that's on page 1 of our source sheet. It's hard for people to hold both. So if you have a Bible, of course, it's good to open up the Bible, and then you'll be able to, if you open up the Tanakh, you can fill in the chart at the same time. So I filled in my chart that the spontaneous celebration of the holiday was everyone drinking on the day of their own holiday. And at the second day, the second year, they celebrated they added something. What did they add? They send gifts to each other. Okay, that's nice. There's an addition. The second year, it's the same Mishteh v'Simcha, but they also are sharing the joy. It's nice to share the joy, right? Let's go on to the next one. Mordechai.
And Mordechai inscribed these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, to enjoin them to make the 14th day of the month of Adar and the 15th day thereof every year. As the days when the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month that was reversed for them from grief to joy and from mourning to a festive day, to make them days of feasting and joy and sending portions to one another and gifts to the poor.
Oi, check that out. Mm-hmm. What did Mordechai said? Oh, you guys had a great idea. Let's have this holiday. Let's just make one little revision. What's the little revision?
Give
gifts to the poor. Shall we play name that tune? Do 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 do. Can you do it? Can you understand what I'm saying? That's I had this problem. I tried it at home and everybody got it right away. Let me try again. Do 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 do. You still don't know what I'm singing? This is why Mayor doesn't like me make kiddush for the men. Since I never make kiddush. I'm singing, I can't smile without, I can't sing it either. A Jewish holiday is a holiday where you include everyone. And we started off by sharing the joy with the people around us. And Mordechai says, yeah, that's a good idea to share the joy with the people around you. But if you really want to be Jewish, you have to make sure everybody's included. You have to have a system of, right, of inclusive volunteer work, you know, chesed towards each other. We have to choose to bring in more people. And the next thing he adds is to add that people accept and people... Here, go ahead. Keep reading.
And the Jews took upon themselves what they had commenced to do and what Mordechai had written to them. For Haman, the son of Hamdatha Agabi, the adversary of all the Jews, had devised to destroy the Jews. And he cast before that is the law to terrify them and to destroy them.
Okay, so we've got four stages in the holiday. Stage one, the spontaneous, what they do the first year. Stage, which is just to drink, everyone in their own home, without anybody else, and without caring what's happening to the rest of the world. Stage two is is also spontaneous, the next year, to remember the next year and to send gifts to each other. Mordechai adds a third stage, which is the stage of sending gifts to the poor as well as to your wealthy friends. Stage four is when the people accept the holiday upon themselves. When they accept the holiday upon themselves, they add something more. What is it that they add?
Responsibility.
Remembering. They add truth, peace, fasting, and lamentations. Davening. When you daven, you take responsibility. You change your... We're not leaving ourselves up to... It's up to God to make whatever happens. We're there to change our own destiny by sharing with each other, by taking responsibility for one another, by remembering each other and remembering our history. And that is what is, that's what makes it possible to have full happiness. So also in the book of Esther is about a day that they choose to accept upon themselves the Torah and do things by, right? We no longer have a gun to our head saying you have to keep the Torah. They're volunteering to keep the Torah, and the Torah that they're imagining for themselves, with a little help from Mordechai, a little push in the right direction, is a Torah that also includes everyone in their community, that pays attention to the fullness of the redemption, that includes that we turn to one another, and we also turn to the poor people around us and make sure we include them. So what I wanted to teach you is that both Esther and Ruth, or both of them, accepting the commandments by choice. They're mitzvot, but they're doing them because they want to. They're commandments, but they're choosing. Esther, in the case of Esther, Mordechai and Esther are teaching them that in order to really have, to really rejoice, you have to make sure that we're not Persians, that we have to create our own destiny, we have to look out for one another, We have to make sure that we have the pieces of the welfare state. We make sure that that everyone is there with us. We send gifts to the poor, and in the book of Ruth, there already is a biblical welfare state there, and it's a good welfare state. But Ruth teaches us not just to fulfill that welfare state, but also how to do it with chesed. How to not to shun the elderly, not to shun the foreigner, to be aware of the generosity and the need to do it well. And that is actually what allows us to be redeemed. I hope that we're able to build that world together, a world where we have no choice but to do volunteer work, but that we'll do it with the joy of not of someone who's forced to do it, but of someone who really wants to bring redemption. Thank you guys very much for learning.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.